I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Later in the hour, we talk with Jesse Saperstein about his new book, Getting a Life with Asperger's, Lessons Learned on the Bumpy Road to Adulthood. But first, in March of 2000, dozens of whales began stranding in the Bahamas, which led a marine biologist to the conclusion that the strandings were caused by nearby Navy sonar tests. The Navy disputed the charges and held firm the sonar exercises were vital to America's national security. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. War of the Whales outlines the battles of whales versus Navy, and author Joshua Horwitz joins us in studio. Welcome.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back a little, because you spent summers here in Quissett growing up, and so you have this connection with Woods Hole, and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution plays a prominent role throughout the book. And there's, I think, a lot of behind-the-scenes things that people aren't aware of, as in including the Navy being involved really early on in whale research.
Right. Well, what first drew me to the story is all the layers of hidden information, beginning with the dark oceans and all the mysteries surrounding whales. But one of the mysteries that I took a lot of pleasure and interest in uncovering was the history of this Woods Hole research community, and specifically Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, which before World War II was a sort of sleepy academic institute. And then during World War II became a center of investigations into various kinds of anti-submarine warfare having to do with ocean acoustics and whatnot. And then after the war continued to be a major Navy-funded lab as it is today. And I didn't know that when I was growing up. I mean, I wasn't working here at Woods Hole, and I knew all the cool science stuff they were doing. But what I didn't realize is that a lot of them were civilian or downstream from military projects that date back for decades. And it's not just hardware. It's also marine science having to do with marine mammalogy in whales, because some of the very earliest and most important research up until the present has been done here at Woods Hole.
Yeah. Now, of the 17 whales that we just talked about that stranded, 14 were beaked whales, which raised immediate concerns because it's so unusual to find a mass stranding of these particular whales.
Right. Some whales, such as pilot whales, commonly strand. But this species of whales, which in fact there are about a quarter of all whale species are what are called beaked whales. And the reason most of us don't know about them is because they spend most of their time diving at great depth. They turn out to be the deepest diving. And again, this is a product of Navy research. We've discovered they are the deepest diving marine mammals in the world, or creatures in the world. And they go down 2 miles. Mm-hmm. They've been recorded diving. And these particular whales lived in the Great Bahama Canyon, which is the deepest underwater canyon in the world. It's about three times as long and deep as the Grand Canyon. And these whales have been living there for 30 million years.
Yeah. They say, what, like 90 minutes they can stay under?
Yeah, they had evolved over these tens of millions of years to dive deeper and deeper. They can go down 2 miles over, almost 2 hours, the longest recorded dive, which was recorded by some Navy technology, these suction cupped recorders that they were able to attach these animals. And they're down for almost 2 hours sometimes, and they do this continuously, and they spend almost no time at the surface breathing air.
Right. There's a section you have in the book where you describe the heads of the whales. I wonder if you could read that for us.
And I just want to note, the reason the whale head is so critical to this story is that when these whales stranded and many of them died, there was a whale researcher on site, and the way he created an evidence trail that was able to connect the dots between Navy sonar and mass strandings was by cutting off whale heads and dragging them into a deep freeze. So this is a character who's very expert in this area. A beaked whale's head tells the entire tale of its remarkable evolution. Its cranium is almost twice as thick as a dolphin's, the better to withstand the extreme water pressure at depth. Its dense, beaked rostrum is both a powerful weapon against male competing battle and a potent defense against sharks. The beaked whale's sound-emitting powers originate in its navel cavities, which transmit both communication sound and sonar clicks. Its concave forehead cradles an acoustic lens, or melon, that focuses sound into different beam forms. Its long jawbone conducts return echoes and incoming communications from other whales to the three small ear bones common to all mammals, which are nested well back in its head. Elaborately convoluted with an enormous auditory cortex, the beaked whale's brain is a masterpiece of signal processing. It can conduct multiple conversations simultaneously, as well as translate biosonar echoes into exquisitely detailed three-dimensional maps.
Amazing. When you think about now, this scientist you're talking about, Ken Balcom, who's a beaked whale and killer whale researcher, and he happened to be living and doing research in this area, so he comes across one of the first, you know, beached whales. But what was interesting also about him is he spent time working with the Navy. So as this goes on, he has some insight that other researchers might not. So tell us a little bit about Ken and his Navy experience as well.
Well, again, this is why once I dug into the story, it was the sort of story no writer could walk away from, because it was sort of, I mean, the subtitle for my book is A True Story, because my publisher was concerned that people would think it was a novel if we didn't have that right on the cover. And the fact is, he's probably the only person in the world who would have known, had an inkling of what was going on, because it was such an unusual event, and who to call at the Navy, because he had gone to graduate school with the person who at the time ran the marine mammal program at the Office of Naval Research, and who happened himself to have a very sophisticated understanding of underwater sound having to do with his own Navy past. So he just happened to be there at this research station. I mean, he'd been there for 10 years, so it wasn't an accident that he was there. He'd been there for 10 winters surveying this understudied population of whales. And he happened to be there the day that the whales came ashore. And it was very mysterious at the time because it was in the morning. There was no sign of any military activity. And he himself, who had been studying beaked whales for 4 decades, had never seen a live beaked whale up close until the day one stranded literally in front of his house alive, and they were able to push that one back out to sea. But he had never, they're so elusive and shy that he'd never been that close to a living whale before.
One of the things too that, you know, this can read like a novel in spots, as they're trying to save some of these whales, and then the sharks are hanging out waiting, and it's like you're like, oh, is it going to make it?
Well, I hate, you know, I hate in the wake of Jaws, which really vilified whale sharks, to kind of introduce them as scary elements. But in fact, in the Bahamas, it's called an Eden for sharks because they've suspended line fishing of sharks, and it's just they have always been the top of the reef along with certain whales. So they're a constant presence there. And once you have blood in the water, as you do with whales who are scraping themselves on coral. Right.
Another person in the book, Darlene Ketton, she's a whale and human hearing expert, forensic pathologist with Harvard Medical School and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Tell us about her discovery as they're collecting these heads. And we should say, when they're collecting them, they're in the center, they disintegrate somewhat. It's not useful. So you've got to get them in the right time. And I think Ken was the one who froze some of the heads, which were helpful. But she discovers pooled blood inside the skull. And what's the significance of that?
Well, and again, she didn't discover this story follows the heads from the time that Ken Balcom cuts them off, drags them into a deep freeze. The Office of Naval Research arranged to have Darlene Ketton be sent down to lead an investigation on the ground. And she's based here, but I think she was coming in from California at the time. And she was the first person who really came up with the idea of looking at the insides of whale heads using CT scans at the time when they were just first being introduced for medical use on humans. And she was studying hearing at Johns Hopkins in the medical school there, and was looking at cetacean hearing, and subsequently works at Harvard in that area. But in any case, she had Balcom and his wife Diane Claridge, who was his research partner at the time, they literally carried two of the heads on a commercial jetliner from the deep freeze in a sprint one day all the way up to Harvard before they defrosted to look at them. So what she developed was this amazing technique of doing essentially a digital dissection where you can do a 3D modeling of the inside of a head. And what they did see that night, 3 a.m. in this underground lab, was pooling of the brain on both sides of the brain, which is significant. And what this was a sign of is what's known as acoustic trauma. And because if it had been on one side, it could have been a whale lying on with its head on the side of the thing. But this happened in the water, clearly, and that was sort of the smoking gun,
right,
if you will.
And so it becomes pretty clear that the Navy sonar caused the whales to beach, at least to Ken Balcom and some of the others he's working. But that I was interesting that that's not what killed them, though. The ones that did die died from heat stroke.
Well, right? this is sort of a parsing of what killed. It's sort of like if I pushed you in front of a bus and the bus hit you, can I blame the bus for killing you? And frankly, that was sort of where it devolved to in the courts. And the fact is, yes, a whale who dies on a beach of heat stroke dies of heat stroke, but these whales never ever leave this deep canyon. In the Bahamas, you have this very deep canyon and these long shallows. So to flee this canyon for the lethal destination of a beach is a desperate act of an animal that's disoriented and injured and panicked at what's going on in the canyon.
It's interesting, too, and I know this isn't part of the book, but just looking at this whole question of why whales or other mammals, why they beach, and looking over history, it seems they've done this, and we still don't know why. Scientists still go, well, what happened? What's going on here? Here we can see some clear evidence of the reaction to the sonar, but I wonder if that helps researchers somewhere down the line answer that other question, the bigger question of why the others who haven't had access to sonar beach.
Right. Well, it's any time a whale, particularly live strands, whales die at sea and sometimes wash ashore in storms. That's common. But for live strandings of whales, it's always a mystery. And in fact, the National Marine Fisheries Service is empowered they are the investigatory body for unexplained mortality events. They call them UMEs. And that's what this was. And they investigate them because there can be multiple causes. There can be algae blooms. There can be, pesticide runoffs. There can be people shoot it, use whales for target practice. There are all sorts of reasons that are detectable. Sometimes there are parasites in their ears. There are a range of different things. There's one theory that's most interesting to me is that it's thought that some of these whales have long migration paths where they're following the iron ore deposits that tend to run north to south to the North Pole. But when there's an earthquake, those plates will get rearranged and sometimes they'll follow it on shore. Hmm. And if you have animals like pilot whales where they follow one leader, that's how you end up sometimes with a pod.
So the Navy does eventually admit that the sonar caused the strandings, but that took a while.
Well, yeah. It took Ken Balcom becoming a genuinely reluctant whistleblower when he realized after he had delivered the heads to them that he was expendable to their investigation. He was concerned that the Navy – one thing I have to say about the Navy is anytime something goes awry at sea, they are the first to really rattle the cage to figure out what happened. They have very rigorous systems in place for what they have after-action reports, and they want to know what went wrong. They don't want to repeat mistakes. They've been historically much more reluctant, however, to share their findings with the public. And that's what Balcom feared was going on. And he had history with the Navy, so he knew the pattern there. So he decided to step out and become a whistleblower and eventually force them to investigate in a more transparent way. And they did eventually release a report, though. They released it at 5:30 in the afternoon on the Friday before Christmas, the typical time you try to bury a report. But it did come back to haunt them because that became that admission of causality became the basis for the lawsuit that Joel Reynolds of Natural Resources Defense Council was able to carry forward.
Right. So Joel Reynolds, of course, another key character, the attorney, as you said, who takes on this case against the Navy, which ultimately ends up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Yeah. Tell us a little about Joel.
Well, he's a remarkable character. Again, I had two wonderful protagonists in this story. In some ways, Ken Balcom was an everyman. He was a scientist who was sort of dwelling in the shadows, who steps forward at a key moment in his life, late in his life. He was 60 years old at the time, or relatively late. Joel Reynolds was remarkable in a different kind of way, in that he was someone who, as a layperson in this marine science, he was not a marine mammalogist at all. He was a environmental attorney who was used to prosecuting endangered species cases having to do with land animals. So he was very sophisticated about the laws protecting endangered species and whatnot. But what he was one of the first people to start seeing the connection. There were a few scientists who had hypothesized a connection between naval sonar exercises and mass strandings of particularly beaked whales. And there had been incidents of this in the Mediterranean, but no one had swept in and gotten a fresh specimen. So the Navy was always able to say, well, we just don't have enough evidence to draw conclusions, which was, I think, convenient to them. But they certainly knew there was a potential issue. And he, Joel Reynolds, in the 90s, about 5 years before this mass stranding in the Bahamas, he took it upon himself to start traveling around the world to marine mammal science conferences and say, listen, you guys should be, and women should be, looking at this problem. There's something going on here. And they were saying, well, you know, if there were a connection, we'd see it. And then when they started looking at the horizon after mass strandings, not infrequently they would see battleships. And, you know, gradually this consensus that there was an issue here began to build. But Joel Reynolds really didn't have a case to bring to court without some kind of physical evidence trail. And that's what this Bahamas stranding provided for him.
We're talking with Joshua Horowitz. His new book is War of the Whales. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Joshua Horowitz. His book is War of the Whales. What's also interesting throughout the book is we follow this case, but there's also a lot of history that you've weaved into there. Top secret submarine programs from the Cold War. You've got that, when they weaponized the dolphins, which I think a lot of people are familiar. They remember that story. Shamu from SeaWorld. I mean, there's a lot of other sort of interesting historic points in this.
Well, and something I knew nothing about going into the story. I sort of got hooked into the story following the legal case when it was heading towards the Supreme Court, and it was sort of the whales versus the Navy and environmental conservation versus Homeland Security. And but then I started to dig deeper into the backstory, and it turns out that the Navy has this decades-long fascinating history with whales that I knew nothing about. I think most people don't know anything about, except perhaps the weaponized dolphin angle. But what happened was the Navy scientists were the first people to figure out that whales echolocate, which is to say they have biosonar that's been, again, like these whales in the Bahamas. All toothed whales have very sophisticated biosonar, and the Navy scientists, again, right here from Woods Hole, Lawrence Chaville and his wife, Barbara Lawrence, went down to Marineland in the first marine park in Florida, and brought back a dolphin, and using a pond here in Quissett, were able to confirm this theory of echolocation. Since the Navy figured that out, they became very intrigued with reverse engineering this biotechnology so that they could translate it into their own technology, because it's the same technology that they've used for decades in a much cruder form to find enemy submarines in the ocean depths. And at the time, this is the Cold War, where they had a terrifying enemy, which were the Soviet armada of submarines that were armed with intercontinental ballistic missiles, as were ours. And they had to track every single one of these in the ocean. And so they said, well, if these animals are so sophisticated, what can we learn from them? So they started a very intensive covert program to study these animals. And they were also training them, because they saw from the marine parks that you could train these animals, these small cetaceans, not just dolphins, but also orcas were trained, and pilot whales and beluga whales. So they're all on the small end of the scale, but these are all highly sophisticated biosonar animals, so they could sweep mines from a harbor. They could tell a decoy mine from a real mine. They could find objects lost 12 feet below in the mud in the ocean floor. They could patrol harbors for enemy swimmers, which they did in Vietnam. And we're still using them today in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf, because none of the technology the Navy has developed in terms of dolphin drones, which they have developed, can do what these dolphins and small cetaceans can do.
It really talks about how intelligent and sophisticated, even going back to when you were describing the skull of the beaked whales, that concept of being able to carry on multiple conversations at one time.
It's mind-blowing. I mean, the limits that the Navy kept running up against with its own acoustic warfare, if you will, was what's known as signal processing. You know, they could send out a lot of sound, active sound, into the ocean and bounce it off things, but they couldn't read the echo back because there's so much going on and so much clutter, and it was just, and as their signal processing improved, so did their ability to do that. But these whales, if you look at their brains, their auditory cortex is I think it's three or four times the size of ours. It's enormously complex. And the idea that they can, that dolphins swimming in pods or herds can carry on a half dozen different conversations simultaneously is a mind-blowing idea. Yeah. And the Navy was interested in that, too, because they need to communicate underwater.
Navy sonar, of course, you know, we're talking about the Navy here, but they're not. That's not the only sonar that we're finding in the ocean. And in fact, in a lot of ways, this book really highlights the impact of noise pollution itself in general in marine life.
Right. And I hope that's what people take away from the book, because aside from being a great story and a great story about social change and whales and submarines, the real threat is not just from military sonar, which, to the Navy's credit, has come a long way from where it was in terms of mitigating risk. But it's what's known as an acute source of sound in the ocean. But the chronic sources that really threaten not just marine mammals but all marine life are international shipping, which is continuous, and it creates a continuous ambient drone in the ocean. And the biggest problem is oil and gas exploration and extraction, which is ubiquitous around the world now, and is just makes it very difficult for whales to communicate, to hunt, to find their mates, to migrate. Everything has gotten hard.
We think of the ocean as the sort of quiet place, and it's not quiet at all anymore.
Well, even before man-made noise, there are lots of noises. A lot of them are, you know, the animals themselves make noises. There are underground earthquakes. There are lightning strikes on water. But this sort of human noise, the sound load in the ocean has doubled every 10 years for the last several decades and continues to.
So you never truly win a conservation battle. The best you can do is win the right to fight another day.
Well, this is sort of the motto that Joel Reynolds and I think the really successful conservationists, whether they're attorneys or fighting in other venues, understand, because and I think this the court cases that are narrated in the second half of the book really illustrate that, because you can't ever win this battle, because you have to remain vigilant against future threats. And so you can lose. If you're fighting to save an endangered species and they go extinct, that's a loss to the planet and to, of course, the species themselves. But if you can protect, as Joel Reynolds found, you know, he had a string of victories starting in 2003, and at the hardest possible time to take the Navy to court. I mean, you have to remember, back in 2003, we were at war in Afghanistan and Iraq. It was a time of the peak patriotism. Certainly, since World War II, hadn't been a time when the country was as unified behind the military as they were then. And that's when he had to go to court, because that's when he had the case to bring. And you don't choose your battlefields; you fight them where they come to you. So, but I think that's really one of the takeaways here. You have to remain vigilant, and both he and Ken Balcom have remained on this and haven't let go of this for 20 years.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little about where we've come in this fight to protect the whales. You sort of mentioned the Navy has come a long way. So where are we? And with research into protection of whales, they're doing some of that as well.
Well, the title of the book is War of the Whales, because it really is, I think, a culture war as much as anything. And you have these two seemingly opposing sides, which are the Navy culture and the Save the Whale conservation culture, if you will. And these court cases, I mean, it's sort of climaxed in the Supreme Court, but the court cases continue. I mean, this war is really a series of battles, and they're not all in courtrooms. I mean, they're at sea, and, you know, Sea Shepherd and Greenpeace are fighting against whalers, and people are lobbying and for orcas in captivity in SeaWorld and elsewhere, you know, and that's a sort of public relations fight, if you will, though also a legal one. This particular battle is this particular war is unfortunately continuing to be fought out in courtrooms, because, you know, my view, and I think the view of other people, some people, is that really the Navy and the conservationists are at a point where their differences are narrow enough that where they should be able to sit down and really come to some consensus about. Because this is really all about where they train for sonar exercises. And the fact is, you do need to train for sonar. It's a difficult, perishable skill. And this is mid-frequency sonar, which is the most dangerous kind to whales, is mounted on every warship in the fleet practically. So you need to just come to a consensus. where they've arrived is night and day now with where the Navy was 20 years ago. So there's some hope there, but there are still strandings. There was a stranding in April in Crete during U.S. And Greek and Israeli joint naval exercises, and five beaked whales stranded and died. And there's an ongoing court case in Hawaii and California that NRDC and Earth Justice have brought over sonar. So there's more work to be done.
So everyone's in agreement that sonar does some harm. And so really the question is, you know, what do you do about it? And I guess depending on who you talk to, there's different answers.
Right.
But you brought up a point somewhere that I read where you talked about, I think it was the Air Force and the simulators they use. Is there some kind of a compromise? Like maybe the Navy could do some sort of simulated training. Obviously, they still have to do some and not do it in the migration paths of the whales.
Well, that's the sort of common sense. It's not as simple as that. But the common sense solution is don't train in whale habitats when the whales are there, because some whales are transient. They're migrating through, like the right whales who migrate up and down the East Coast, and others are resident. So if you have a known resident population that's vulnerable to this, don't train there. It's a big ocean. The Navy, of course, feels they have to train in the environment where they're going to fight. And so if they're going to have to fight in deep underwater canyons, they have to train there. So this is where, you know, they're butting heads. But I think, you know, yes, absolutely. The Air Force has used simulators. I mean, it's been pointed out you can simulate a lot of air flight, but if you're going to land on an aircraft carrier, you can't do that on a simulator. You have to actually learn how to do that. And I know that anti-submarine warfare experts would argue that you can't do it all on simulators. And I, you know, so the question is, how much can you do? Mm-hmm. And this is where I think, you know, the courtroom is perhaps not the most efficient way to work out these details, because it tends to come down to legal technicalities rather than, okay, though, you know, they do. They talk about geographic exclusions, seasonal exclusions, buffer zones around coastal areas where there are more whales. And, you know, I think along U.S. coastlines, the Navy's doing a lot better in terms of really surveying for whales and whatnot. Unfortunately, the Navy also does a lot of exercises overseas, like in the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. where they don't have the same vigilance, and that's where we're still seeing problems, right. I think, more notably.
And the process of, I mean, you know, they sort of had, I think at one point President Bush had said, you know, national security comes first. They can sort of do what they want, but there's a better process now. They have to go through more.
Yeah, well, the courts rejected that. At one point on the way to the Supreme Court, the Navy went to the White House and said, please just give us a waiver of all these environmental laws, or particular environmental laws that we are in violation of. And the Bush White House did that. And then the courts threw that out and said, you can't go around the judiciary. So that's when it went to the Supreme Court. And even in the Supreme Court, I mean, nobody has ever said the Navy is not accountable to environmental laws like the Marine Mammal Protection Act and Endangered Species Act and whatnot. And so and the Navy acknowledges that. It's just a matter of, it's around the margins. Unfortunately, the margins is where these animals live often. And some of these are endangered species, and they can't afford, you know, even a few casualties.
What are your thoughts on public opinion? You know, I'm thinking when Ken had the video of the beach whales, and whenever people see them, it's heartbreaking to see this, you know, these whales or dolphins or, you know, fighting for the breath and dying on the beach. But we don't see a lot of it. I mean, maybe we're seeing more of it now. But in some ways, that did impact the case, and people were like, what,
Absolutely.
This is happening? So yeah. A lot of it, in a way, is just us educating ourselves as to what's happening.
Well, I think it's that, but it's an interesting byproduct. On one hand, Ken Balcom happened to also be a photo identification and documentary person who had built his career on documenting, you know, identifying whales visually. So he actually was able to videotape the stranding and photograph it and document it that way. And those ended up on 60 Minutes and elsewhere. And that was a big part of breaking that story. The other big thing is the internet, though. That has mm-hmm. changed things a lot. So, and that's part of this story in my book, because the internet is just becoming a force. There are listservs among marine mammal scientists and whatnot. And so things travel faster. So I think that there is better and Blackfish is a great example, the documentary about captive orcas. And there's been a tremendous amount of movement having to do with really public opinion. You know, Southwest Airlines just decided they were going to break their decades-long ties with SeaWorld. And, you know, all sorts of aquariums are now taking a second look at their dolphin shows. And so I think that public opinion, one of the things that I discovered that was interesting to me is, and it was consistent as I interviewed mostly retired admirals and other Navy people, that the Navy is very sensitive to public opinion. I mean, you wouldn't think they were. These are tough guy warriors generally. However, they hate it when they're portrayed as bad stewards of the ocean. They take great pride in areas where they've been very good and ahead of the curve in that area. So I think public opinion is an important part. And that's another lesson from this book, is it's not just what you do in the courtroom. It's about, you know, it's all of these factors working together.
You mentioned that the sort of Navy history was a bit of a surprise to you. I'm wondering, as you're putting together, because there's so much history along with this particular court case we're talking about, what was the biggest surprise other than the early Navy research as you were going through all the research for this?
Well, I guess one of the surprises is that it was actually a couple of Navy researchers, specifically people like John Lilly, who some people may know, and Roger Payne, who first recorded or popularized the recordings of humpback whale songs. He used to be a Navy-funded researcher. That some of them got sort of too close, if you will, to their research subjects and flipped and became really the patriarchs, if you will, of the Save the Whale movement. And it's on one hand very ironic, and yet I found among the whale scientists, and there are lots of them I've interviewed over the course of the years on this book, all of them have become, you can't work around these animals. You can't study them either in captive or wild settings without connecting with them. And we have this deep primal connection to whales, and it's a conflicted one because we've been hunting whales for millennia, and yet we've also been investing them with meaning, and they have meaning to us in all sorts of ways. So that surprised me that they were actually Navy people at the beginnings of the Save the Whale movement.
And we mentioned John Lilly. Boy, talk about some unconventional methods, but yeah, I don't think he would be able to get away with that today.
Well, I mean, he got into trouble because after getting Navy and other financing for his research into cetacean communication, which he had a big lab in the Caribbean, he was experimenting with LSD with them. And at the time, LSD was legal, and there was a lot of he was an NIH researcher. And so this was not uncommon to be using LSD on – this was in the mid-60s before it was illegalized, early mid-60s. However, he then started taking LSD and with his whales and trying and getting a little far afield from traditional scientific method. And so he was somewhat ostracized by his colleagues who had used to look up to him as, again, one of the great whale scientists at the very beginning of that discipline. And yet he kind of went off the deep end. But then he was embraced by and really created this whole New Age movement around whales. So you know, one man's meat is another man's poison. I don't know. He's a fascinating character. Yeah, that was one of my favorite characters in the book.
Yep. War of the Whales, A True Story, Joshua Horowitz. Thanks so much for coming. A really fascinating book. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after a break, we talk with Jesse Saperstein about his book, Getting a Life with Asperger's, Lessons Learned on the Bumpy Road to Adulthood.